Everybody, good evening. Welcome to Evoke Therapy Program's broadcast. It's June 24th, 2019. Tonight's broadcast is about how long a child needs to stay at Evoke to complete their treatment. It's probably one of the two or three most commonly asked questions by the parents of participants, sometimes by the participants themselves if they're young adults. And so tonight I'm going to talk about the thinking that goes into it. And I'll say this probably more than once this evening. It's not a simple matrix. It's not a simple equation where it fits, one size fits all, and you can kind of define it that way. There are a lot of kind of moving parts, different aspects to consider. The first thing that I want to talk about tonight is this idea that when you ask the question, when one asks the question, it all depends upon your goals, right? It depends upon what you're trying to accomplish. So that becomes a weekly dialogue with your Evoke therapist, and that length of stay gets co-created by the parents and the Evoke therapist, if it's an adolescent, and also co-created to a large extent between the client, if they're a young adult, and the parents and the Evoke therapist. So that's kind of the overarching theme. That's why it's not a simple answer. I can talk about our averages. Our averages teeter around 9 weeks on average, a little bit shorter for young adults. But that doesn't answer the question about really what we're looking at when we wonder how long this process is going to take. Thinking about where it all starts. First of all, you're interrupting a crisis, right? You're trying to create a moment to stabilize and find out what is needed, what's going on diagnostically, and what's the next step. I like to say all the time, it's not great to make long-term decisions in a short-term crisis. And so sometimes you just need a moment to take your breath, and that goes for everybody. And to relieve yourself or your child from that crisis point, and then begin to look at, again, what's the big picture? What's needed here? What hasn't been working? What is the child, young adult or adolescent child, needed in their life that's not been present? And can we create that going forward? People ask about next steps often, even before the child is enrolled in the program. And what I can say about that is we start thinking about that from the moment that a participant enters our program, right? That becomes, I like to ask it on the front end, on the first phone call with parents, is what were you thinking? What was your thinking coming into this about what you might be doing for the next step to see where everybody's at? What are the goals that people are setting themselves up for? And then you're getting that assessment, and then you're starting treatment. I think one of the most common mistakes that people make unconsciously is that old idea of, here's my child, fix them, and when they're done, send them back or they can graduate from the program. These problems aren't going to be fixed in 9 weeks, but we're going to get a good start at it. And we're going to be able to more clearly define what the problem is. The way that the language that I like to use when I talk about this is, what is the project? And even in my own work, while I have a lifetime to go in terms of my own personal therapeutic work, I have a sense, because of the work that I've done and some of my own intensive work, I have a sense of what the project is. And that can be redefined and honed a little bit as I go along. But I have a good sense about what the picture is. And that's what we're trying to get to, at least by the end of treatment, is being able to define what the project that someone has to work on. We're looking at levels of functioning. You know, that's one of the questions, is based on where they're coming in and what the next setting might be, what level of functioning? That's just a phrase that refers to kind of how symptomatic one is. Obviously, if they're younger and going to a more acute aftercare program, then you can deal with a lower level of functioning. If you're talking about going home or going back into a mainstream environment, then you're going to want a higher level of functioning. So again, you've got to know what the goal is and what the next place is and kind of match those up with each other. And like I said, goals. Changing the goal. I was talking to a parent today about our many various programs. I was talking about intensive work. I was talking about our pursuits trips, which are short-term experiential kind of therapy light programs, and then I was talking about our traditional wilderness program. We were talking about the pros and cons of each of them with regard to their child and what might be the best fit. And at the end, they said, what's our next step? You know, should we call or start talking to admissions? And I said, the next step is really to decide what you want. And they said, what is your recommendation? I said, it depends on what you want, right? It's that old story about which of the forks in the road should I take, the one to the right or to the left? And that all depends upon your destination or your goal. So it really begins to develop a dialogue with everybody involved when you think about these kinds of things, about what the goals are. And those aftercare plans become a critical aspect of it. And I think it really does speak to a fundamental idea in therapy and how we think about therapy. I tend to think about therapy as a lifelong process, the same way I would think about a physical regimen, right? That you don't ever arrive. You can't go to the gym and get in shape. Everybody knows this. And then when you get in some kind of ideal shape or goal, when you get to your goals, if you quit maintaining it, if you just stop right there, everybody knows what's going to happen to your body, right? It's going to regress back to an earlier phase, right? Or get worse. It's the same in my mind with therapy. So I don't think of therapy as a short-term problem-solving mission. That happens in therapy for sure. But I think about it as figuring out what you need in life and what kind of therapeutic support. Does it need to be Al-Anon or AA? Does it need to be traditional outpatient therapy? Do you need a sponsor? Are there other support groups? Do you need to take on a regimen of yoga or meditation? Do you need to make sure that your self-care looks like a certain thing? So all of that gets figured out in this process and gets defined. It's co-created, like I said. It's not a simple answer. Even if I was your child's therapist and I knew your child fairly well, I had had him for a few weeks and you said, how long should my child be there? I wouldn't be able to answer the question without asking you 3 or 4 or 5 questions back. So you start to discuss the things that I'm discussing today. It's not, like I said, it's not like if you do well, you leave earlier, and if you struggle, you leave longer. There are sometimes the need to leave earlier if you're struggling. And sometimes even if you're doing well, depending upon where you're going to next, staying longer might be the ticket. You know, the age of the child's going to matter. Children that are over the age of 18 tend to stay a shorter amount of time. There's some buy-in or investment that must occur for them to stay engaged in the process. And so they tend to leave a little earlier than adolescents. And they're a part of the choosing. They don't necessarily get to write a blank check for themselves, but within the constraints that the parents set up about what they're willing to support, the child is, we're often encouraging, almost universally encouraging the child then to have some choice in that process. Sometimes when the child is turning just 18, you might want them to leave before they turn 18 for a couple of weeks so that they can get to step 2 and have some engagement before they turn 18, that critical moment where anybody can walk out of treatment. Or you might want to keep them past 18 because they're so fragile that you would want them to get more of a buy-in here. And it all depends upon where they're at in their program. What's the history, right? How primary is the issue? Is it a stage of life thing? Is it just kind of getting back on track because it's been a relatively short length of time? Is it developmental? Does it look like a personality disorder developing? That's a more a cemented kind of personality challenge. Psychiatrically, is there medication that they've been introduced to here at Evoke? And so we see a significant change with that. All of those become part of the questions, become part of the planning and be part of the decision-making. Again, are they going back to an old context? Or what is the aftercare plan that everybody's hoping for? Some clients will say, well, if everybody knows I'm going to an aftercare, then why don't I just leave now? If you know what that is. And part of that is because aftercare changes, right? As some of the kind of the sharp edges get taken off of the demonstrative behavior or the level of functioning improves or increases, you qualify yourself for a higher level of care. That's why wilderness can be so effective as a first step, is that you can get yourself into a type of treatment that looks more mainstream. And by the way, let me be as clear as I can. The more mainstream the setting, the less therapeutic support, and the more difficult it is. I want to be as clear as I can. The less therapeutic support, and the more difficult that it is. Now, it also, by adolescents and young adults, is also more desirable, the more mainstream it is. But I think one of the mistakes that parents make is simply looking at the child's desire, you know, playing into that too much, not running it through the parent or the adult filter or the therapeutic filter and saying, I understand what they're wanting, but we may think that they need more support. I want aftercare to be appropriate for your child on their worst day, not their best day or their average day, right? If the aftercare setting is not appropriate for your child on their worst day, then what's going to happen? It's going to be a bad fit for them. They're going to be kicked out or asked to leave, or they're going to struggle profoundly. So I tend to lean, and this came from experience, more conservatively in my suggestions. It also relates to where the parents are at, because the more mainstream the next setting is, the more the parent is involved in maintaining the boundary, the more communication, the more visits, often home or to the program from the parents. And in that sense, you're not being insulated from your child's ups and downs like you are in wilderness and like you are in some settings that have more support and structure to them. So those are some things to think about and why we make the recommendations that we make. Again, the more like old contexts, the more difficult it is, period. What becomes the value then of the current treatment? Well, it becomes assessment and recommendation. It becomes moving from levels of care, right? And also you want to take all of that information and feed it into the next program, the next professionals. I talk about this idea of antibiotics and the relativity of time, of the time. This is true, I think, for all of us at all stages of life, but probably particularly true for young people. The time now seems like an eternity. A week or two or three or four seems like an eternity to a young person. And when you're in a difficult or painful or uncomfortable situation, that experience, that warping of time is exacerbated. But I like to tell that to the parents, at least, so that they can not be so anxious again at the child's struggle to kind of accept the limits around time. We all know that if you take antibiotics for an infection, that you have to finish the dosage long after the symptom disappears. And it's the same in treatment, right? I think it's vital to finish the course of treatment that fits for the issue and for the child long after the most difficult, the most challenging symptoms disappear. Thinking about the transition, you know, making that transition. In the program that I worked at before we started our program in 1998, we called it graduation. And immediately, the day we opened our doors, we called it transition. Because it doesn't matter where you're going, even if where you're going is home, you're not done. And so let's not think about it as an ending, but rather a step to a new place. You're creating a plan. You're measuring the level of buy-in. I always noticed with my clients, my adolescent clients, I always noticed that the ones who were more demanding about the next step, in the sense that they were saying, I need this, this, and this to be okay, were the ones who needed more support, right? They were externalizing control. Whereas those who would say, well, I would love to have this, I would love to have that, and I would love to have something else. And my best thinking got me here, number one. And number two, I'm open to what everybody thinks is best for me. There's an element of surrender. We talk a lot about buy-in in the therapeutic world, but we don't talk enough about surrender. They talk about it in addiction work, but surrender can also be present in work when you're dealing with straight mental health. It's not a complete blind faith. It's not never asserting your need, but it's the client that says, the most important feature in the success of the next program is me. And it's not going to be perfect. We're going to try to get, you know, all the things that we think we can get. We're going to prioritize them also. So all needs, all wants aren't equal. But in the end, it's when the child says, I'm the most important ingredient in the success of my next setting. That's when I think they can be afforded more privileges, right? More mainstream, more temptation, really, is what you're doing. More exposure to triggers. Less, they require less support, if you will, when they've internalized the control, the success of their long-term progress. When they get very specific and demanding, and there's kind of an implied threat, if I don't get, you know, co-ed, listen to my own music, not wear a uniform, you know, traditional visits home, things like that, my phone, whatever it is, if I don't get those things, then I'm going to sabotage it or I can't be happy, then you know they need more. And it's this weird, ironic kind of tension. I would use it to explain it. You know those little handcuffs you would get when you were a little kid from the dollar store? And they were just these little kind of wound things you would put over the end of your fingers, and the more you pulled, the tighter they became. It's kind of like that. You kind of have to lean into. I was always impressed with students who would disclose really big things late in their therapy. I remember one student who admitted to illicit drug use that we didn't find on the testing and that she had never confessed to throughout the program, but 2 or 3 days in the week leading up to her departure from the program, she admitted to some significantly qualitatively different drug use. And one of the questions came from parents was, should we keep you there longer now? And I said, no, this is, we're first of all, she was going to a therapeutic school afterwards anyway. But this is a good sign, right? This is her letting go. This is her really surrendering to the process and telling the truth regardless of consequences. It's a really good sign. Like I said, you can change the level of care the more progress that you make. Sometimes that means the longer that you stay. You're trying to smooth out the rough edges and the initial resistance. Wilderness can deal with a really high level of resistance. And while we often think of resistance as synonymous with oppositionality, right? Rebellion, refusal. Remember that resistance is also looks like hyper-cooperation. The most common resistance that we get taught about as therapists in our training isn't rebellion. It's flight to health. It's saying the right thing, trying to look good, trying to sell your therapist and the therapeutic staff on you being cured. And that might be because of shame, or that might be also increased or exaggerated when how you show up is going to determine your next stay. Even adults, high-functioning adults in the community who are going to a therapist at home have a difficult time showing up in a therapist's office as they are, right? So you add that to the equation of the accountability that comes with recommendations afterwards. And there's a lot of reasons to hide your problems and your pathology. I always teach our therapists, never lose sight of the fact that we're in a very unique position as therapists in wilderness therapy, that some of the disclosures, some of what they can admit to, confess to, could impact where they go next. And that amplifies an already powerful feeling of vulnerability to admit your faults or your issues, to confess to things. The idea that this is a change of life styles, right? It's a different way of being, not just merely a diet to get to an end goal. Many of you know this, but I know I have a dog in the fight, so to speak. I'm biased, but this is the most powerful, provocative intervention you'll probably ever experience as a family. And it's okay to take advantage of it a little bit longer. parents, if you meet up with parents who have been through this process and they're years out, they will tell you to a person, not everyone, but a large, large majority, that wilderness was the most powerful, impactful part of their child's entire journey. So it's okay to take advantage of it. I know the creature comforts aren't there. I know that people want to get back to quote-unquote mainstream, traditional, front country life. I know that. But when we're talking about a couple of weeks, it can make big, big differences. When we started our wilderness therapy, every wilderness program in the United States at the time was either 7 weeks or 3 weeks, with very, very little variation. And because of what we started to experience in our previous setting before we opened ours, we knew that it had to be variable length of stay, and there was no variable length of stay wilderness therapy program in the United States. And now there is no wilderness therapy program that is not variable length of stay. And we knew that at the get-go. Take advantage of the lulls, the regressions, the valleys, and the plateaus. Early in my career, I really loved it when students or clients were peaking as they finished our program because it made us look really good. But what I learned through experience and remaining in contact with family over months and years' time is it's ideal that they experience some regression, some setbacks while they're with us. That it's not ideal for clients or students to transition from the program at their peak. So it's okay for them to be here and say, I'm bored. You know, there's nothing else I can do here. That's the same kind of complaints, the same kind of sentiment that they often express at the next setting. So let's deal with that here in this wonderful place that it's so easy to romanticize, especially if we transition people at the height of their progress. So lulls, regression, valleys, and plateaus are an important part to kind of work through. Maybe more important than the wonderful strides forward. The diminishing returns. There is a point of diminishing returns, of course. And the sentiment that a client expresses that I'm ready to go might not be worth taking at face value. I used to say to my clients, again, you know when it's your time to leave because somebody will be here to pick you up and take you back to base. And until then, it's not your time. And so what are you going to do with it? Because life is not a series of great strides forwards. Life is crooked and difficult, and there's moments of getting triggered and regressing and boring moments. I used to run Ironman triathlons and marathons. And I remember that the greatest challenge in an Ironman wasn't the day of the race. An Ironman is 2.5 mile swim, 112-mile bike ride, and a 26-mile run, okay? And that was not the hardest day of the race, not even close. The hardest day of the race was 6 o'clock on a Tuesday morning when it was freezing rain outside and I had to go work out by myself. That's the hardest moment. The race, the celebration, that was the most enjoyable of all of the days of my marathons or my Ironman races. So borrowing from that idea and that metaphor, it's really about the subtle moments, right? Not the exciting celebratory reunion moments. When we started bringing parents, and we were again the first program to do this, to bring parents into the program in the middle of it, rather than just at the end, somebody told me along the way, you're really taking away from that end reunion. It's becoming very anticlimactic. And at first, I was kind of defensive because they were right. And as I thought about it for a couple of days, I thought, good. I'm glad that we're taking away the climax of the reunion at the end of the program because life isn't like that. And I've worked with enough families now, I said to this person. I've worked with enough families now to see that getting home is more like a Tuesday morning at 6 a.m. than it is like graduation night where everybody's celebrating. You learn to listen to what your child wants, what they think, what their desires are, and you run it through the adult filter. Now, young adults become much more a part of the decision-making process, right? Typically, the parents along with the young adult, we'll study two or three approaches, models, support structures for after evoke, and then the child is given, the young adult child is given a choice within a range. That's typically how it goes with the young adult. With adolescents, the question I'm often asked is, should we ask them what they want, what they think? And my answer is always. I always want to know what my student thinks they need next or want next. That gives you a clue into where they're at. It gives you some insight into how deeply they've been impacted by it. I'm listening for those ideas of surrender that I talked about earlier. I'm listening to how superficial some of the requests are versus do they have more depth? Are they more tied to the therapeutic work that we've been doing here? So always listen. You just run it through the parent filter, the adult filter. After evoke, what happens? You know, I get asked the question, why do so many of your students and clients, it's about 60%, give or take, maybe 65%, why do they go to aftercare settings that are residential in nature? And the answer is experience. My theoretical bias, my predisposed thinking and ideas on clients in wilderness was that they should go home. That's what I thought when I started the job 24 years ago. That's what I thought it was. That's what my training had taught me. But then after working for a while, I thought it often doesn't work best for the child. See, you don't get two or three or four or five experiences to look at how it goes. You get one, yours, right? If you have two children, I suppose you get two. But you don't get to experiment. I get to watch this huge cross-section of clients and all kinds of issues, diagnoses, levels of functioning, and the choices that they make. And oftentimes, these settings can be best for them. Maybe it's because of the history. Maybe it's how it's ingrained. Maybe it's because the old contexts are too triggering. But whatever it is, it's experience that has shown us, that has dictated our proclivity to suggest aftercare of a residential nature. As you're considering in this, it's important that you're honest with yourself. Are they your needs or your child's needs? And that's okay. There's nothing wrong with one or the other, but just looking at yourself honestly and saying, what is this for? Am I trying to make up for something? Am I trying to make them happy or get rid of the guilt or resentment that might be there? It's okay to say, I'm not ready for them to come home. And they can be mad about that. Many of them will be, but it's okay for you to take care of yourself. And I think one of the biggest challenges I've had as a wilderness therapist is when it's not clear that the decision-making is coming, at least is consistent, where the parent is saying it's coming from and where it seems to be coming from. Like I've talked about with level of care, I think the biggest misunderstanding about next steps is that lower levels of care are going to be easier, and they're not. They're harder, period. And that's okay. My son eventually came home from wilderness therapy, right? He came home after a relatively short stay in aftercare. And it was harder at home. It's more difficult. And we were ready for that. And we knew that. And we knew we had built some bridges and that we had inserted some ideas or some fundamental shifts in the family and in him that would help us going forward. Sometimes a two-step process, sometimes it's a three-step process. And I'm not talking about where somebody regresses and goes backward. That happens on occasion. But I'm talking about sometimes the levels of care kind of gradually go down so that you're getting less and less support because the child is functioning at a higher and higher level. It's what has worked for us in our observations. I love the juggling analogy, and I think it's important. I'm going to share it again. In wilderness therapy, or primary treatment, a lot of our clients and students get good at juggling three balls. If any of you know how to juggle, you know what that's like. I can juggle three balls. And then when you hand them two or three more, they drop them all. That's just the way that it goes. And it's not because they have forgot how to juggle. It's because there are more balls. Now there's a more profound expectation around schoolwork or work if they're a young adult. They're exposed to staff members who aren't as trained as wilderness staff members and who are coming in shifts. Our staff come in for 8-day shifts and don't leave. They're not as insulated from the world, from temptations, from stress, from triggers, from you. Ram Dass says, if you think you're enlightened, spend a week with your family, right? So it's more difficult, more balls. And I think when we think about it in black and white terms, that when they drop all their balls, that we're back to square one. We're not. It just takes a while to learn how to juggle 4 balls and 5 balls and 6 balls. You can do it, but it's qualitatively different than juggling 3 balls. I talked about the aftercare bias that we have already. I used to say, this is more for parents. This is for you to know and not to repeat. If they can handle a yes, then they can handle a no. I always thought about that. If the privileges that they're asking for, right, that they're advocating for, the freedoms that they're advocating for, if they can deal with those, then they can deal with the boundary of no. Simple as that. And so their inability to deal with a no, it gives you a glimpse into where they are at. And I'm not saying that they can't be unhappy or frustrated or angry or sad. They can be all of those things. In fact, ideally, you learn to listen to all of those things. They can disagree with you. They can think that you're wrong. All of that. And responding to the boundary without creating symptoms or problems around it is an important part of the progress. It's often not until you've closed the door, meaning that when you've said, no, it's not an option, or in the case of a young adult, we won't support you coming home. It's often not until you close that door that they will begin to accept it. If there's a little crack in the door, right, a little bit of space, the pleading, the negotiating, the promising, the selling will often be present. And so there's this time in between you close the door where they threaten to give up, to never forgive you, whatever it is. There's a space after you close the door where you'll get all of that, where they'll start to say, I was shocked. I wish all of you could have this experience. I couldn't believe it. The first thing I learned about in wilderness therapy was how resilient children are. I could not believe, and even in those early days, I myself was in my 20s, and I could not believe how well kids could deal with some of the boundaries that were being set with them, both in wilderness and after wilderness. Because they were telling me often, I can't do this. This is unbearable. And there's this kind of growth process between anger and resentment and defiance and resignation to acceptance to eventually some buy-in, where they would be saying by the end of the program, you know, it's probably what's best for me. I don't like it, I wouldn't choose it, but I can see how it can help. And that's amazing. And when I started to see that, didn't know what was going to happen, and started to see that, that's when I realized how resilient they were and how wise their parents were in kind of choosing a supportive, appropriately matched aftercare program for them. Listen to the experts and then you get to make your own decisions. Skipped a couple. First and foremost, it's really what I say every broadcast. Do your work. If you want another thing that can contribute to your child's long-term growth and success, it's to do your work. That's the most important contribution you can make. So going to the meetings, getting your own therapist, coming to an intensive, whatever it is, listening to the broadcasts, reading self-help books that fit with what's going on for you and your child, that's what you can do most. And make it a lifelong process. For me, it's a life-changing process that never ends. And it impacts all of my life, all of my relationships. While our children and their struggles might be the thing that invites us into this work, the work becomes about us. So do your work. Be honest with yourself about your why.
I always say to a family, I'm not going to challenge what you do. I just won't. You get to do what you do. I may challenge why you're doing it. And if you're doing it because you can think that this is a guaranteed fix or something you can control, I'm going to challenge that. Like I said, listen to experts and make your own decision. Listen to all sides and talk to the schools and programs and the parents that have been through the process. And see what you can hear. Identify your needs and your child's needs. And remember, if there's one simple thing that I can offer tonight in this broadcast, it's shifting the idea that anybody, including our children or us, can just be fixed and arrive. You're either open to change. You know, I hope, I have an 80-year-old therapist that I've been seeing for the last 20 years. And she still is growing and learning all the time. She's probably one of the best students I've ever met in my life. She's constantly going to conferences and classes and excited about what she's learning. And I don't imagine that she'll ever stop. And she said to me one time, a lot of people die long before they're dead. And I want to keep learning. She just got back from a trip to Italy, her, I don't know, 7th or 8th or 10th time there, and is already planning her next trip because that's one of the ways that she learns and grows, is exposing herself to different contexts and cultures. So there's that. Happy to take any questions. Let me go to some of the upcoming and information and announcements, and then I'll take questions. We would like all parents to go to 6 12-step support groups. Any combination of Al-Anon, CODA, Families Anonymous, or Adult Children. You can go online and find programs in your area. Isle of Teen is for teens. RefugeRecovery.org. You can find an organization, Refuge Recovery, that is Buddhist-inspired and has less of an emphasis on a higher power. NAMI.org is a place you can go to get resources and classes that are free in your local area. These broadcasts are available on the podcast app for the rest of your life, and they're available to the public. The webinar version is only available to current and former families, but the podcasts, the audio recording, are available to everybody. So please continue to share those and get those out there. You can find them on an iPhone, an Android device, by the various podcast apps, or by going to soundcloud.com. On Twitter and Instagram, you can find us by searching Evoke Therapy, or you can also find the Evoke Summit Lodge on Instagram. On Facebook, you can find us by searching Evoke Therapy Programs, the Alumni Foundation, a program, an organization set up by former parents and alumni to help people who can't afford therapy. If you want to become involved in that, donate to that, volunteer there. Go to Facebook and find the Evoke Family Foundation. Our blog is available with updated content each week, constant new information. My book, The Journey of the Heroic Parent, is available on Amazon. Audio, electronic versions, paperback is available there. If you want to do a deep dive into your own work, a real investment in yourself, finding you is the intensive for individuals. A lot of people want to do family intensives. I really implore parents to consider doing their own individual work before they do a family intensive. I think it makes a big difference. The next one is actually coming up this week. So if you're not signed up, you're probably not coming. The next one is July 10th. These go for 4.5 days. Contact intensives at evoketherapy.com. Parent support groups coming up. Bay Area, we're still setting that up. Chicago will be on July 29th. Southern California will be August 11th. Email Melanie at evoketherapy.com for more information. Excuse me. We ask all current parents, if they can, to come to a workshop. The next one will be July 20th through 21st. So if you're in the program now, that will be your next, maybe only, opportunity. Contact Melanie at evoketherapy.com for more information. Pursuit trips are anywhere from a few days to a month of adventure, therapy, light reconnection run by our staff. You can also combine that with some therapy with a therapist if you want to. It's kind of a buffet where you get to pick and choose different activities, different parts of the world, how long you want it, and who you want involved. All right, I'm happy to take any live questions. First question is, how do we balance the need to plan ahead for aftercare and buy plane tickets, etc., with the desire to let the therapeutic process unfold? Very fair question. I also want to address the financial question too, by the way. You didn't ask that, but I'll address that. Here's the way that I would do it with my family, is that I encourage our therapists to do it this way. You can schedule, you can take a good guess fairly early on in the process at an ending date and a visit for that. With this caveat, if you get, let's say you pick week 9 and you pick that around week 4 or 5, okay? Let's say that as we're approaching week 9, it doesn't look like that's the right time. Still make your visit, and then the child can leave 2 weeks later. Maybe there's not place at the next setting. Maybe clinically we've figured out that they need a little bit more time. They can leave afterwards. So your visit is still planned, but it changes the nature of the visit. That's how I would do it. Of course, we would love to have the luxury as therapists to be able to tell you the week before, but that's not reality. It's just not. So it's a fair question. So schedule according to your needs, but be flexible about what that might look like in terms of what's going to be the nature of the visit. Is it going to be a visit to do some therapy work and then take the child to the next setting? Or does it change? Should it be just a visit and then the child goes to the next setting on their own? Or with the transporter or with just one of you? It just flies out later. So that's an important piece. I wanted to also say this. I didn't mention this, and I think it's insensitive of me to not mention this. Finances are a part of your life, and all of this is tremendously expensive. And so you get to ask questions with that in mind. That gets to be a part of your equation, and there's no shame in that. It's okay. And it ought to be respected and understood. Someone says, when you say close the door, can you expand on this? I just mean when you're done entertaining the option of them coming home afterwards. So some of the residential placements that happen after Evoke, when you've said it's not an option for you to come back home to the same school, to the same setting, having therapy once a week, we're not willing to do that just yet. That's what I mean by closing the door. It's not until that happens that they begin to really make progress into the acceptance and ultimately the investment of the next step. Next parent asks, what if the parents who are divorced have different options for the aftercare plan and are struggling with communicating effectively about this? I mean, that's a tough one. Home therapy, when my son and my wife, my ex-wife and I, my son's wife, my son's mother and I, we weren't at odds. We just wanted to work on co-parenting therapy. Listen to the co-parenting webinar or podcast. It's important. And by the way, it happens in families where they're divorced or where they're married, just so you know. It's not just divorced families. There are often almost as many intact families where parents have very different ideas or approaches to parenting. So co-parenting therapy is important, and it's really a few layers deep. I think it's harder for divorced families to do some of that work because you've already decided we're not compatible. It's kind of like we're going to agree to disagree and divorce. A little bit easier maybe for married partners who are still committed to the marriage to kind of get a few layers deeper and understand it, but there's no simple solution. It's your own work and co-parenting work. And if your partner won't do co-parenting therapy, then do your own work. Because it would be, if you were my client, it would be a lot of discussion to figure out what you could feel good with, what were your boundaries, what rights do you have, if there's different custody agreements, and what can you live with or not live with? What are you willing to compromise? What does that look like? So forth and so on. So it's a tough question. Thank you for asking it. If we plan on aftercare, on an aftercare program, and the kid won't go, and we say you can't come home, where do they go? Well, this only applies, of course, if they're a young adult. If they're a young adult, they can walk away. And you can say, you're on your own. They'll have a plan. In our program, we take them to the local homeless shelter. And again, it's often only after they really, really think that the parents have closed the door do they kind of turn it around. So you don't have to, unfortunately, you don't have to solve that. And you don't have to hold that line either, by the way. You get to choose that. But if that's where you get to, they're going to threaten. They're going to try to emotionally do what they can to get you, what's been successful for them in the past, to get you to do what they want you to do. But ultimately, you have the right to hold that line. And the fact of the matter is, every parent is going to have a line, right? None of us are going to be willing to support anything our child asks for. So it's not about whether or not we hold a line. It's just about where we decide that line is. Another parent says, I've heard from my therapist that I should pace myself with my financial resources and think about this when considering an aftercare program. Any thoughts about this? Absolutely. That's just kind of what I was talking about with the money. That's important. I always wanted to ask about that when I was talking with my clients or the parents of my clients, because it's a real variable. Unless there are some people that have unlimited resources, but the vast majority of us don't. So you get to decide, and that gets to be part of the equation. Again, I think the best money you can spend is to do your own intensive work. I really do. Get your own therapist. So figure that into the equation also. I think that's the best investment you can make in, ironically, your child's progress. One parent asks, how many weeks in advance does the therapist know the end date? It just varies. It varies on all the variables. I ask you, how much time do you need in advance? That's a question. And that's probably going to be how much time in advance that I'm going to give you, because you need that. Maybe it's your work schedule or, you know, whatever it is. Other children, other life responsibilities. So my answer to the question of how much time in advance does the therapist know, it's the time that you need. And if you need 10 weeks, I'm going to do it in 10 weeks. I'm going to give you 10 weeks notice. And if you give me the opportunity to give you 1 week or 10 days notice, I'm going to use that. Right? So you get to decide that. Just be clear about that with your therapist. Say, I know it'd be wonderful if I didn't have to ask you this, but I'm going to need 3 weeks or 4 weeks notice or 2 weeks notice. It's okay to say that. It really is. And if they stumble or stutter when you say that, you just tell them Brad said that it was okay for me to tell you my needs in this equation. All right. I think that's it for this evening. Thank you for joining us this evening. I hope these broadcasts, all of them, are helpful points of contact. More than anything, I want to introduce you to a way of thinking, a sensibility is what I call it, because all of these broadcasts, no matter what we're talking about, whether it be a specific diagnosis or in this case tonight, the length of time and treatment, all of them invite us to think in uncommon ways. So I hope this is helpful for you and helpful for you. We plan on doing these for as long as we have breath in our lungs. So we love doing these for you, and I love joining you, and I love seeing how many people show up on a night like this, because it tells me how invested you are in the process. And your children know. They can feel it when you're doing your work. They really can. So thanks for joining us this evening for and on behalf of your child. Have a great week. I'm going to be on vacation for a couple of weeks, actually. So we're going to have some guest facilitators. So the next broadcast is to be determined. And so we'll be sending out announcements soon about those. Take care, folks. Have a good evening. And I'll see you in a couple weeks. Bye-bye. By the year you'll be